As soon as we get the rest of the people's attention here. Mr. Berry? Bill? Could we get you to come and sit with us at the table for a minute here? We've already called a meeting order. We've had several hearings on House Bill 657, and we've heard a lot of different viewpoints on the subject matter. And I wonder if you could just perhaps run. I noticed you pointed out to me that in Title 38 there, where apparently the Division of Lands already has zoning authority in the unorganized borough. So that would probably get around some of the fears that were expressed by some people, thinking that giving the Division of Lands the platting authority would in effect give them the zoning authority.
Yes, maybe I should discuss first the difference between platting and zoning.
Everybody, it might be helpful.
Everybody seems to think they're the same things. They are not.
Right.
The simplest way of putting it is that zoning relates to the use of the land, and platting relates to the development of the land. Essentially, when you're extending these powers, currently the Division of Lands has the power to vacate plats in an unorganized borough.
Which means exactly what?
Let me start back a step further. What happens is, of course, that a plat is filed currently in an unorganized borough simply by the plator with no requirements of approval.
He files it with the Division of Lands?
No, he files it with the district court, with the recorder. The land is at that stage subdivided. Currently, the Division of Lands has the authority to vacate a plat. A vacation of a plat, of course, has, among other things, the legal impact of changing the description of land and dedicating streets, dedicating public spaces, and creating a new system of references to lands. There's a fairly complex set of statutes about what happens when a plat is vacated. Vacation of a plat, in effect, removes it from the record, and the land goes back to the original state. In effect, it then becomes undedicated lands, and the dedicated public ways and so forth go back in accordance with the method set up by statute, which, if you have more than one owner, can get very complicated. If you don't have, it just simply becomes no longer a dedicated street.
Well, let me try to simplify that in my own mind. A person in the unorganized borough can file a plat at the district recorder's office.
Right.
And the Division of Lands now has the authority to vacate the plat.
Right.
Which means they can come in and reject.
No. Vacation, of course, is after the fact, and vacation of a plat is something that if rights have grown up and you've got user situations, a vacation probably can't be accomplished. Let's assume you've got a plat and you've sold off various lots. And people, for example, let me use a very extreme example of an instance that you couldn't vacate a plat. Let's assume you got one of these big square plats, let's make it the worst kind, with a road running up the middle that's dedicated. Assume that somebody comes in and plats like this. This is the only road. So they take this piece of land and they cut it into six lots. They dedicate a road going here. And let's assume that they sell lots one and lot three over here. Now, if you come in with a vacation of the plat, the ownership of the dedicated road would go essentially like this. The original owner would own to the center of the street here, off lot two, would own all of this, and would own to the center of the street here, which, as you see, the net result would be that the lots he has sold no longer has access if you vacate at this stage. So vacation, and of course, you just simply can't do this. This would not be a case that vacation would be allowed.
Who wouldn't allow it?
The statutes on vacation would not allow vacation without provision
What would happen, Bill, if they'd never sold any lots?
If they'd never sold any lots, there's no problem. I was just saying vacation is not the same as initial control. Once you've sold lots, then you have a more complicated situation. Then you have to vacate so that you preserve the rights of everybody. And as I say, I used an extreme case showing a flat access cut off. A vacation would not be proper. This authority, the Division of Lands, already has. The addition really runs from sections 150 to 210, and I think 150 is the key section. This is what platting is really about. Control of form, size, other aspects, subdivisions, dedications and vacations of land, dimensions of lots or tracts, street width, arrangement and right-of-way, including access, installation of street paving, curbs, gutters, sidewalks, sewer, water line, drainage, and other public utilities, facilities, and improvements. In other words, they could provide in the unorganized borough the kinds of things that I think all of the organized boroughs provide now. That is, that before you're allowed to subdivide land, you must either make or make provisions for certain improvements such as water, sewer, roads, and these depend on the kinds of development needs of the area. This is essentially the extension that would be given. Under platting, you cannot control the use of land. The platting authority does not say that you may only use this subdivision as an industrial, for industrial purposes, or for residential, or for what have you. That's the primary distinction. One is development, another is use. We're not dealing with use here. You do get into an area that's somewhat difficult to analyze on the periphery of platting powers. For example, obviously lot size requirements can have an impact on use. Obviously the requirements that you put in water, sewer, roads can have an impact on use. Further in platting, the kind of extreme cases on platting have now held it under platting authority. You can do things like require dedication of public easements along streams, that you can require open space dedications, that you can use a cluster development, for example, that you put the houses close together and require public open spaces, or that you can require dedication of lands for schools, or in lieu of a dedication of land, a payment to the subdivision that provides schools. As far as platting, this is about the periphery. There just is not an awful lot of case law on the extent of platting. It's something that doesn't get to court very often.
Is there some kind of a standard or criteria that they use? In other words, let me dream up a case here. Let's say there's somebody wanted to make a subdivision out in an unorganized borough somewhere, and whoever has the platting authority didn't want him to do it there under any circumstances.
Right.
Is there some kind of reasonable limits within which they have to operate before they can say no? In other words, can
yes.
they be arbitrary and unreasonable?
They may not. Platting, first, the platting standards must meet the, quote, arbitrary and unreasonable test. If they're arbitrary and unreasonable, they cannot be sustained. And the arbitrary and unreasonable, you have to show a direct relationship to public need. Platting is a tighter power. Secondly, let's assume that you've adopted platting regulations. Somebody comes in with a plat. This plat meets all of your regulations. And it's in an area you just no way won't develop it. Doesn't matter. You must approve it if it meets the regulations. So you do have stricter controls. Another point that I brought up, since the question was directed to me on use controls in an unorganized borough, is the fact that it appears under 3805037 that the Division of Land already has zoning powers in an unorganized borough. The statute is rather clear to me on its face. It was brought out to me that this wasn't the intent. That may or may not be. I went into legislative history and came up with what I consider an absolutely fascinating pattern. The original bill would have made it very clear: the Division of Land shall exercise its zoning power in the unorganized borough only at such times and such areas it's requested to do so. as Section B. The current Section B, they leave Section A allowing full zoning power and say the Division of Land shall exercise its zoning power within federal lands in unorganized borough only at the times, etc. So on its face, the limitation would have seemed to make the limitation applicable only to federal lands, leaving the full zoning power in other lands. The committee report indicates that this might not have been what they were talking about, but the committee report in the on page 659 of the 1966 House Journal is just simply not that clear. There's a subsequent interesting committee report. This was carried forward into the unorganized, into the municipal code, and the committee report on the Free Conference Committee on the Municipal Code said, the present provisions of Title VII granting authority to the Division of Lands to adopt zoning regulations for federal lands in an unorganized borough at the request of the Secretary of Interior and only for the purpose of facilitating federal land sales in an unorganized borough is placed in Title 38. But all that did was just move the thing. I recognize the intent argument, but I would be very inclined to say that when you read the statute as it exists and consider that if they wanted a full limitation, all they would have had to do was make that...
they would have had to delete Section A, right?
No. If they would have put the phrase within federal lands instead of in Section B, if they would have put it in Section A immediately following power, it would have been an across-the-board restriction. They chose instead to put it in B and wrote a somewhat ambiguous committee report. I'm inclined to... I think it's questionable, but I'm very strongly inclined to think the division currently has this authority. It's true they haven't exercised it. You've got contemporaneous construction, but...
I'm inclined to agree with you. Just by reading it, it's pretty darn clear to me that they have the power.
The intent just didn't make it that clear to me that you've got a statute that's fairly clear on its face. You're going to intend, and the intent just isn't that clear. I've given you a copy of what I consider the relevant materials.
Here's the Title 38 down the bottom that he's talking about. You want to take a look at this.
The question you'd have to defend, and if you were saying it did not have the power, is that in fact the Resources Committee in 1966 goofed and put the amendment in the wrong place and incorrectly expressed their intent.
Yes, sir.
The fear that I have had has been that there was some kind of an ulterior motive here that was going to allow the division to stifle or prohibit development in certain areas, and that this was some way of giving them some kind of zoning authority that they didn't have. But reading the statute, looks to me like they already have all the zoning authority that they need. And if they have that, that would be a greater tool, would it not, to prevent development than you could ever come up with platting.
Platting is a relatively weak tool in many ways. It's a very important tool in some ways, but as far as use is concerned, it's a very weak tool. Zoning you can do much more with, as both of us know from experience.
I'll point out also that you probably, many of us got a telegram from Willie Goodwin from RealCap, and he suggested that the Department of Community Regional Affairs Division of Community Planning be granted the platting authority rather than the Division of Lands. In discussion with Kevin Waring, he wasn't able to make it today, but he told me that he wasn't opposed to that and thought that it probably would be a little more appropriate. Yes.
Can I help you help sort this out now? That it's already established by statute that the Division of Lands has the zoning authority.
Right? Yeah, is the unorganized.
That statute, though, there is an argument that this is inadvertent, that if you look at the title and look at the intent, it does not give the authority that it appears to give.
Well, especially as this limits itself to fighting.
I think the relationship, there is a relationship, but it's not that intimate, really, between platting and zoning.
Well, could you explain, I don't want to run over the whole thing again, but how do you mean it's not as broad as it appears? or the authority is it?
The argument is that... The 3805-037 is confined to federal lands in the unorganized borough. That was the intent of the statute, and that when they put in this within federal lands, they intended it to apply to the entire statute, not just to B. So that therefore the division does not have authority outside of federal lands within the unorganized borough. I indicated why I think this is a highly questionable interpretation.
Because of the intent.
Because let me sketch this again. Do you happen to have a copy of that statute?
Yes.
Take the phrase which they added at committee on the first line following zoning power within federal lands is what was added by the committee from the original bill. If they would have added that same thing following power in paragraph A, it would have been extremely clear to have been limited to within federal lands. They also added paragraph C, the requirement of approval on being concurrent resolution. But for our purposes, that isn't material, and that's what they really discussed. But you see the heavy distinction between putting that in B and putting it in C. And the argument would be that had the committee correctly expressed its intent, they would have put it in A.
As it is, it's just a qualifier of the power granted in A. B is just a qualifier or a refinement of the power that's granted.
You have, as I read the statute currently, you have a very broad power in an organized borough, but if you're dealing with federal lands, your power is limited by B and C. That's the face of the statute. This gets into the merits, but Jack, just to ask you, I mentioned a paper plat problem. All of you realize that one of the great needs of platting, and anybody that's been in municipal government is well aware of it, people file a paper plat, they subdivide the lots, they follow no logical criteria, they put in no improvements, they just have a paper road, but no real road. People start building it, and ultimately, as it gets developed, this paper road isn't adequate, so somebody has to develop the road, that, or the water, or the sewer. That, of course, is the great argument for platting controls, the classic argument.
You see any problem with changing it to Division of Community Planning?
The only problem I see, of course, platting is a highly technical thing. It's almost purely technical, and one of the things that you do need with that is you have a platting is an engineering involvement from the standpoint of the platting authority, much more than a planning. You do have planning and engineering involvements, but there's very heavy engineering involvements. You have to check the subdivision, you have to make sure that the plat closes. You have to check things like the slopes and the grades of the roads. I wouldn't want to speak for the departments, but the Division of Lands has the surveying and engineering capability. I don't know where CRA does or not.
I'm sure they don't. Or I would assume the Division of Community Planning doesn't have the cadastral engineers and so forth that are available at the Division of Lands. And in that case, it seems like if we were to give it to the other division, it would cause them to have to take on some more people in order to perform the function.
I think the division would have to speak to that, but they would have to arrange to perform it some way.
Yes. Ramona?
Was there a fiscal office? I don't have one like that. I was just wondering.
No, we didn't.
In either department, I would think it would be out of working that a lot. Other
there is a fiscal. There is? Oh, okay. My fault.
As the department would say, a relatively modest one.
Oh, yes. fiscal note for this year calls for $58,000, next year $74,000, and it goes up about less than 10% a year. They call for two new people this year and three new next year. They're asking for a new cadastral surveyor one and a clerk type of three. And that's for this year. Next year they're asking for, in addition to those two, a civil engineering assistant three. So that'd be for the fiscal 77 budget, would be asking for three new people. And that's where you get the $74,000 fiscal note for next year. And I assume it would be higher if we were to put it in community planning. Mrs. Redden?
I still have reservations about this bill for the reasons I expressed in our last hearing, that I feel that it's a way of discouraging third-class boroughs from recognizing it and being willing to take on local government functions. Planning and zoning and planning are local government functions. If you have a function of local government, they've gone so far as to have a third-class borough, then the progression of things is that this is the beginning of a local government, and as they recognize new problems and new areas where they need to work, then they take on new powers. And for the state to step in and say, for third-class boroughs, we're going to do the platting, to me seems to discourage the development of strong local government and also encourages a dependence on the state that I at least don't want to encourage. I want to encourage strong local governments.
Of course, there's only one third-class borough right now. And if it just seems, no, I think we had the same argument last time. It seemed to me
I just wanted to restate it because we got so far away on the planning and zoning and the organized borough and so on. And really, with this bill, all we're talking about is extending an authority that the Division of Lands already has on planning into the complete planning authority into the third-class borough. Already, the division has the authority to hear and act on petitions for the change of vacation of plats in the third-class borough. And what we're doing is extending complete platting authority into the only third-class borough in the state. And to me, that simply doesn't seem to be a desirable thing to do if we believe in local government and if we believe in the progression of local government as taking on new powers when you recognize it. Right.
And we just disagree. I think it would work exactly the opposite as you think.
Well, other people have told me the same thing.
Well, does the committee have a further questions they want to take care of on this question, or do you want to?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that same problem with it that Lisa does because of the fact that there is only one request borough, and I can't picture them cropping up anyway. And what we're covering is a large section of the state which is not third class boroughs or any kind of borough, where there is an absolute vacuum as far as this sort of authority.
That's already granted. The only change we're making is to include the third class borough in complete planning authority.
No, it isn't. We're also giving the complete planning authority to the total unorganized borough as well.
Well, it's already there.
No, I believe the same provision that applies to third class boroughs at the present time, only for the change or vacation of plats, also applies to the unorganized borough. Am I correct?
Oh, yes. Unorganized borough.
Yeah. Wait a minute.
Because it was restricted, if I'm not mistaken, to what the language is being removed.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're broadening it to cover.
I'm sorry, in the area outside the planning boroughs and outside cities in the unorganized borough. And third class. Oh, I see.
Here's your primary change.
Yeah, right. I see.
Well, and also, isn't it, Mr. Chairman or Mr. Barrier, that we're deleting that language that restricted it to. For the change of vacation of plats. That was in there
I
before.
See. I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
Yes, the real big change is deleting this language and adding these sections.
Yeah.
The change is statewide. The third class borough thing is relatively minor, but the big change is the deletion and the addition of the new.
Yeah.
This is in essence.
I thought it dealt only
150 to 245 is the basic platting authority.
Oh,
yeah,
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Do we seem in agreement then that telegram that you looked at, would not be a practical route to go, but that they would require additional?
I can't speak for the department, obviously. Maybe you'd want to ask Palmer.
Yeah, I'd like to.
Well, do you have a comment on that, Palmer? I know it isn't your division.
No, it's not. Now, it hasn't been discussed in the staff meeting. I briefly discussed it with Jack, but I'm not familiar with conversations that me and Kevin.
I think it's a good suggestion, but I personally feel that it's really not all that practical, since the zoning authority is with the Division of Lands, and that as Mr. Barrier pointed out, they do seem equipped to perform the function at the present time, with the addition, as they pointed out here, of the two new people. Is anyone opposed to moving the bill out as is?
I know they know that.
Today is the 20th, is that right?
Bring it down on you to know.
Let me get a little slashes on my wrist and I'll tell you about that.
Mr. Barrier?
Yes.
While we're at it, we had that other bill on the calendar here too, Senate Bill 703.
Yeah.
Huh? Right.
Let's say we pull an element.
Say, Jack, if you wouldn't mind, maybe you could stay too. There may be some questions since some of your experience may be able to shed some light on this next question as well. Could you perhaps just give us a brief as to what this bill is talking about? It seemed pretty easy to understand on its face, but after hearing some of your discussions with Jack a little earlier today, it seems to have become a little more complicated.
Seems to be. It's a fairly simple bill as to what it does legally. It's just a question of, as the bond attorneys, bond consultants, financial consultants, should they be hired by the assembly or their designees under current law, or should they be hired by the municipal executive subject to assembly approval? It's the technical change is that simple. The policy implications are more complicated.
Well, maybe you'd like to go into those a little bit.
Well, really, it's not the kind of thing that that from this job I really should speak to. To go back to past experience, I found that by and large there's been very little controversy over the state as to who should be hired as bond attorneys, but the municipalities have had, from time to time, quite serious arguments about who should be hired as bond consultants and as financial consultants. The question of who determines what your bonding advice and financial advice is can be a fairly explosive question, and it's a question, you have an argument on one hand that the executive, who's either the elected mayor or the manager, is closer involved on a day-to-day operation and therefore is better equipped to select. The argument on the other side is that the assembly is involved in policy, these are involved in broad policy, and they should be able to select policy advisors. I'm somewhat oversimplifying, but I think Jack undoubtedly is more familiar with it than I, but he might agree that this is, in broad summary, the problem.
Please do.
Yeah, I think the analogy would be if you knew that a law firm in San Francisco or Anchorage was drawing down $100,000 being bond counsel for the state, and also that some firm in Seattle or Anchorage was drawing down $100,000 being the financial consultant for the state, what would your role, the legislature, be? What would you want to have happen? Would you want to hand out those $100,000 contracts, or would you allow the governor? That's basically it.
Well, it does say subject to approval of Assembly Council.
Yeah, you come in after the fact and you can ratify it or disapprove it. You can't disapprove it, let's face it. The guy's given the contract to a firm, and there may be some political overtones that no one knows. It's strictly a political question here. And you come along later on and this guy's getting up testifying to what the governor has proposed because it's his package and the governor's package, and they're saying, yeah, go with $600 million with the bonds because the market is right and it's the right thing to do and all these kind of things. And you come in later on and say, you know, you can't distinguish between the financial consultant and the governor at that point. On the other hand, you want to get in early and say, hey, we'll get our financial consultant. Bond counsel, Billy's right, it's not that critical bond counsel, sort of bond counsel. It's pretty standard stuff. Financial consultant comes in and says, you know, I backed the governor, $600 million. If you want to get it early and make it your bond package through the financial, whatever you call it, you could get in early with your financial consultant and make your package, and the government would have to override you.
What's the practice and procedure right now as far as municipalities? This proposes to change.
So in our case, I assumed I was right at the end of the existing law, which was hire the bond counsel and the financial consultant.
The municipal executive would?
Yes.
Well, that's what this is.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I have a definition of a municipal executive.
The municipal executive is one of two types. It depends on whether you've adopted a manager plan. If you've adopted a manager plan, in the true sense of the word manager plan, and you realize why the modification, the manager is the executive. Otherwise, it's the elected borough or city mayor. You have an odd exception that the executive is the elected mayor, not the hired manager, but that's not a true manager plan.
I suspected that's what you were going to say, and that didn't take long for me to make up my decision on that bill.
I'm still a little confused.
Well, pretty exactly right. You know, who's running the show here? City manager or the council? As far as I'm concerned, that's what it boils down to. And 99% of the time, a good city manager is going to consult with the council in the first place, and they're going to agree. And what you're doing here is taking away some muscle from the elected part of your government. And
Mr. Chairman, I don't understand it that way when it does say subject to approval by the assembly or council.
After the fact.
Well, it's your disapproval if they want.
Well, it seems like, I was following that same logic. It seems like, just like any other confirmation procedure, the executive perhaps would hire or appoint this financial consultant. And at that point, the assembly would have to approve it. But now, the situation Mr. Roderick described was that there was a lag there, that perhaps before the council approved him, he'd already made all these consultations with the executive.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think there must be a history to this bill. Somebody's cooked it up under a given set of facts. I just don't know what those facts are, but you're right. That's the way it should work. The executive says, this is the bond council and consultants, and go immediately to the legislative body. But apparently it's not working that way. Something's wrong in some community. And somebody's trying to change it.
I don't have Title 28 now. Oh, yeah. Okay, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
You're talking about home rule cities. Not only general law municipality, but home rule cities as well. And everybody has their own view of the part that the city manager, borough manager's case, maybe he should play in the relationship, their role as far as the elected officials concerned, but in my mind, there's no question, absolutely no question.
Well, what does this mean when it says the governing body or its designee, okay, it makes it pretty clear, the way the statute presently reads, that the governing body or its designee of a home rule or general law municipality shall be the sole contracting authority. So the governing body obviously means the council or assembly.
Or its designee.
Or that the assembly or council's designee.
What does it say?
The governing body or its designee of a home rule or general law municipality shall be the sole contracting authority for bond attorneys, consultants, financial consultants, and so forth.
Is that what this is replacing?
Is repeal, yes, exactly that. It's 2958-315. Mr. Roderick.
I think what that means is that the legislative body then would have to take the initiative. If they didn't delegate it to the city manager or to the mayor, they would retain it. So they have the power, and they would have to act to give it to their designee. Under this law, the executive would act, and then they would approve or disapprove. It's just shifting the order.
Mr. Chairman, but from a practical standpoint, and the way I think it should work, the governing body will say to the manager, we better find a bond counsel or whatever we need. And he goes goes and hustles around and he talks to these people and comes back and says, this is the guy I recommend and these are the reasons I do. And unless they have some, under normal circumstances, unless they have some obvious objection, well, that's it. But, you know, when to give the hired man, and this is what it amounts to as far as I'm concerned, this is the guy that's working for the governing body, to give him the authority to go do something and then come back and say, well, this is what I've done. You, if you don't like it, well, you can say no, which, you know, this is approval. That's
bad. Sounds to me like, I mean, Mr. Chairman, like you're saying the same thing two ways. that I don't see that this seems to me tightens it up, because before we could designate the designee this way, it doesn't allow for that, because you have to have subject to the approval, no matter how it's done. It's the designee does it, or the manager or the mayor, in other words. They still have to approve it, the assembly or council, and it would be the same mechanism. I presume the manager and mayor would pick a person, so the council doesn't want to necessarily direct them. He suggested, like you said, me approve or disapprove it.
I think Ms. Freeman makes a good point. It really is quite a different procedure. Lisa, did you have?
Well, I was just going to respond to what Carl was saying. I think that as far as putting it into state law, I agree with Earl. I don't think it's desirable to put into state law that the executive does this.
There's nothing else that just adds power to the mayor.
I have no objection to any council designating their manager to do that at any time. And so maybe we part company there. I have no objection. In fact, I think it's probably the right thing for a council to do.
That's the way it's law is now.
I mean, the manager can't really manage unless he can choose the, you know, people. But I'm not sure that it needs to be in state law. I don't understand why it needs to be. What does what we're repealing say now?
The present statute 2915.315, which by this bill would be repealed. Of course, the title's the same, bond attorneys, bond and financial consultants. The governing body, or its designee, of a home rule or general law municipality, shall be the sole contracting authority for these people. So it says the governing body has the mm-hmm. has the sole authority to contract, or they can designate someone else to contract.
Personally, it's a Senate bill, and I would like to see somebody over here from the Senate testifying, saying why it was in the Senate, who put it in, you know, or, you know, right. Why it was passed and all that stuff.
Well, I'm certainly not prepared to pass the bill out at this point.
I can't even see discussing it until we figure out what, you know, I think we're sitting here.
Well, I think we're getting the word, learning a little bit about it.
Right,
though.
But I mean,
sure
as far
am.
As the reasons behind it.
Mr. Heckman.
This is the same point, Sam, that was argued when the PTPC bill came up for health and social services. What the PTPC bill did, the revision of it, it gave the administrator the right to go ahead and act subject to the approval of the commissioner. And the way the bill had read previously, they recommended to the commissioner, and the commissioner actually took the action. But it was an opt-out, opt-in situation. And I would have to agree with Oral. I'd be terribly suspicious of, it sounds to me as though some city manager or something like that wants to take some of these neat trips and sign all these bond packages and everything, and instead of some of the city councilmen getting those trips back to New York and Chicago.
That's really all about.
Signing those bonds where you have to sign them by hand is not all that easy.
Those parties afterwards, they tell me, are wild.
I should have got, I was carrying the checks from where I went to the bank.
Well, Mr. Berry, I just have one more question. I think that probably everybody will want to designate themselves as a subcommittee to investigate this further, but the language as I see it says that nobody's going to be hired unless they're approved by the assembly. Like the actual contract can't be enforced until the assembly approves.
What you've done is switch the primary authority. Currently, the primary authority is in the assembly. Under this, it would be under the mayor, the subject to confirmation.
Or manager.
Or manager.
Okay. Anybody have any more questions on this subject? We are adjourned. Senate Bill 529. You may remember that we had a hearing on this, I guess it was earlier this week. I guess the big question on there was whether or not we wanted to let a lien be, or whether we wanted to allow a lien to be held against the property once the exemption was applied for. I guess the way the original Senate bill was, and I think you probably have a copy of that, was that at the time of reimbursement, that the department shall file a lien on each farm in favor of the state. Other than that, the first part, I don't think there's much conflict on it. It was just kind of a protection matter for the state to make sure they didn't pay the borough more than they actually lost. When Mrs. Berry was here, we had three suggested amendments that I don't believe we acted on. Oh no, we did act on the first one that allowed them the timeliness. Just like the other...
allowed them to what, Mr. Chairman?
Allowed them to apply if they didn't. They may waive the claimant's failure to make timely application for good cause. The way the bill is now, there's a restriction that they have to apply before a certain deadline, and if they don't, they can't get the exemption for that time period. And
is that in this language here?
Do you have these sheets? There was a section there that I believe we passed that amendment that allowed them to have that. One of the other questions was how much money they made on the property. Could we let that determine whether or not they could qualify for the farm exemption, or should we leave it at the 10% of their gross income figure?
That's the one I have trouble on. I don't know if I understand their explanation of that. With that $1,000 just on that land that was being under agriculture, or if it that applied to the entire farm.
Mr. Chairman? I have a problem too, because it says from acres from 0 to 40. If they had 1 acre, that $1,000 would still apply, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And that's kind of high, isn't it?
Well, that's the thing. It doesn't seem too consistent to have 0 to 40.
It seems consistent to have 0 at all.
Well,
would you ever have 0 farm?
Well, we assume though that they couldn't make $1,000 out of farm use if they had 0. They might have a flower pot and grow a rare plant or something.
0 stands for that, is that right?
I don't know what it stands for.
You got to start someplace.
0.
Well, it seems like 10 acres, Mr. Chairman, would be a reasonable figure to start with. You're looking at $100 an acre.
Well, the thing is, and then you're saying that anyone with below 10 acres wouldn't be able to qualify at all. I don't know
if that's
what
you're saying. How about 1? Something about that 0 just doesn't make sense to me.
Well,
I guess it only applies, the tax break only applies to the different assessment for the property. So if you've got 0, you're not going to pay any taxes anyway.
Okay.
You could argue, Sam, that the guy is really serious about farming unless he's got at least 10 acres of cultivation.
I think, I don't think I agree with that.
Yeah. Does greenhouse fall in the nature category of farming? It doesn't. If a person
yes,
has
it does.
It does.
Well, in Anchorage, we have 2 of them.
Okay, because that's where I was going to say, with a lot less acreage in that, you could make that much through good production of a greenhouse, because I don't understand the tiny one, how many tomatoes and cucumbers and all that type of stuff I grow. And that's where a very small piece of property could come underneath an exemption than with somebody with a greenhouse at that.
What size green, Mr. Dowser?
What's that?
You gotta get his attention, get his attention.
Say Bob.
I was just saying, the greenhouse should.
Maybe you could sit up here at the table with this.
Oh, yeah.
We can't get your attention back there.
I'm sorry, I was answering another question. Sure.
What is the size of these greenhouse? That's something new to me, that are exempt.
Well, in Anchorage, they have quite an extensive tomato and other produce that this greenhouse, and I think they have investments something like $500,000 each, or at least one of them is worth something of the kind. And there is a break that the assessor there gives for this, decreases their assessment depending on the income of the operation, rather than for an income for other purposes. And he has some ground involved, but as it was pointed out, it isn't a large piece of ground that they're on. I think a couple acres or so.
Do they get that break for the full 2 acres?
They get
the 2 acres assessed differently.
Yes. Well, the 2 acres that I'm not sure of the quantity of ground, but it isn't a large area. But the ground gets the exemption, not the exemption, but the deferred amount of the taxes, as well as the building, because it's all used. It has a cover over it, so to speak, but it's all considered as farm. At least we have considered in the concept of this definition. See, another thing you were mentioning, Mr. Hackney, about cultivation. This includes grazing land and all kinds of different farming activity, and tilling the land isn't necessarily in the concept of the present bill. It's more broad than that.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, Sam, on this suggested amendment, if you were to just remove the three words from 02.
Not to exceed or something?
If you were to say a minimum of $1,000 gross farm income for any acreage up to 40 acres and an additional, wouldn't that sound?
That'd make it a little bit easier to grasp, I think. I don't think it would really change anything.
No, but at least it would make it a...
You wouldn't have to say zero.
What were you suggesting, Glenn?
To say for any acreage up to 40 acres.
Instead of zero.
You could use greenhouse, you could use single.
Oh, say they want
patch. Right, whatever's right.
Do you have a comment on that as opposed to the, of course, this amendment is suggested to replace the 10% requirement?
Yes, I feel that there seems to be considerable action right now with Senate concurrent resolution 92 on the books. I don't know that it's gone anywhere, but that is one to delete any checking on the income whatsoever. There seems to be an objection of the people to farmers to either to show an assessor or to have their income tax checked. Some of them we were unable to find in the Department of Revenue. But so with this in mind, this, and of course Liz has this property, Liz Berry, and the assessor there. She felt that it would be easier for her administering it to check on receipts or whatnot that they got actually from their farm use, rather than their income from many other sources might be outside of the state or from other things. So it might be a better way of administering it to, I've been checking since she testified And I notice that other states are very similar to this. They have a revenue derived from the farm activity on a certain number of acres, and a similar formula to this. Perhaps $1,000 is right. I don't know about it. She seemed to think $1,000 for 40 acres was reasonable. I don't know whether it is or not.
Well, we stopped and thought, you know, figured out they did make, we figured maybe we took 160 acres and figured that would be, they'd have to make $2,200 off of 160 acres.
Yeah, that's pretty lenient, I would think.
Yeah, and then you stop to figure that if that were to be considered 10% of their gross income, that would have been $22,000, of course. And so, again, I'm not, you know, unless we had all the average figures for what farmers made, it seems like these are just kind of off the top of the head figures.
I didn't have any questions, but I was just going to say that I think doing it this way with receipts, for one thing, I think people should have the privacy of not having to prove what their income is, and you might have one of the people that, a person that is, you know, really a gung-ho farmer and has a beautiful farm and produces really well, but he has also, you know, a rich uncle or aunt or grandfather that's left all this money in a trust fund that he gets an income from every month, and it would make him exempt just because it wasn't 10% of his income. Or you could have somebody that, you know, could lay back and do nothing just because it was 10%. You know, just to make it 10%, I think it would be much more fair thing to have it done this way. And I can't speak to whether $1,000 with the $10 for each additional acre is, you know, a reasonable sum or not, because I don't know what the average production cost and what the income is on farmland around the state. But I just really feel that the percentage of the income is not a fair and just means of way of determining that exemption.
Well, I disagree with that. If it's going to be farmland, it's going to be farmland, regardless if it's a rich farmer or a poor farmer.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Well, I say, but then you want to put it on his gross on 10% of his
No,
money.
I said I don't want it that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm
sorry. I think it's completely unjust to do it
that
way.
Oh, okay. Then we're in agreement.
Did you understand that one?
No, I wish you
knew
you.
I don't think I was that muddled this morning.
Well, you got my attention. I
tuned in a little late there.
You know, Mr. Doshi, seeing another one of the amendments that the Senate did there, when they changed the term other than farm use purposes, and they instead used uses incompatible with farm use. I just wonder how that's going to be defined. For instance, again, Mrs. Berry's case, she's got a golf course, a 9-hole golf course, and I just wonder if that would be considered incompatible with farm use.
How can you determine that? That is. Almost any use, I mean, it has to be pretty far out to be incompatible with the surrounding farm use.
I suppose buildings on there, like a trailer park or subdivision or something like that, would probably be incompatible.
So I think the terminology we had already is probably, if it's not in farm use anymore, it wouldn't be. I mean, the terminology is already in the bill, I think. Good.
Mr. Chairman, you mean other than farm use purposes?
Yes.
Yeah, that's I'm clear.
Because then this other way, it opens it up to a determination which I would think would be impossible to define.
They could run a few cattle over now. They could use it somewhat for grazing, that would be compatible to it. Well, all they have to do is run a herd of cattle on, so it. That'll be it.
Or let their horses graze on it. I suppose it's anything to justify the golf course.
What's they do?
Well, again, I think the big question we've got to decide on is whether or not there should be a lien against the property. And the Senate bill, as we've got it now, doesn't provide for that. The original Senate bill did. I remember the question boils down to right now they're liable to pay it, and it seems like in order for the state to collect, they're going to have to take it to court, and it isn't going to be such an easy procedure. And if there were a lien put on it, it was suggested that some people wouldn't take advantage of the different assessment if they had to have a lien against the property. And I can't quite buy that because the difference in the amount of taxes they'd have to pay would be pretty great in most cases.
Well, another thing too, I don't think we should force the people to take advantage of this. They don't want to have an initiative on their own and go for the lien.
How's that?
Well, I don't think we should force the people to, you know, to take part in this. And that's what Nancy is doing. If they don't want to take part in this lien bit, well, then they're not interested. They're willing to pay the whole thing. So I say put the lien in there.
Yeah.
Because there's damn few that want to get some tax relief that aren't going to take part in that lien.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just to get it on the floor, I would move that we reinstate that lien language in the bill. There will be a lien against the property. In other words, the original language of the bill.
Then the state has to take care of that, isn't it? That's all the state's problem.
Yeah. As Mrs. Berry pointed out when she was testifying, the way it's written now, there is the state can't collect it because there is no lien on the property. The fellow can move and go somewhere. And if the borough tried to collect it, they would have to collect it on a personal action against the owner and who sold it. And there's, again, it's almost would be practically impossible to sell it under the, or to retrieve that money that they have in it. But it's state money, and they're the logical ones to have the lien on the property.
Was there any other discussion on the motion? Anybody opposed to the motion?
Yes.
Well, all in favor of the motion, I'll put it that way. Raise your hand. Opposed?
Mr. Chairman, I did tune in on that subject a little late, but was that Mrs. Berry? What was her testimony on that? Was she for that?
She seemed to be concerned about the borough having to go through a lot of the administrative functions there as far as collecting it and so forth, whereas if there's a lien in favor of the state, well, the borough still gets paid, and I think, and if there's a default, well, then the state has to collect. So I think that she was worried about the responsibility of the borough, and so after she discovered that there really wasn't going to be any real hassle. I see Palmer shaking his head.
No, I mean, yeah, you're right.
Okay. So I think that she was satisfied after she kind of understood it a little bit better. That was my understanding of her testimony and her reaction.
Yeah, I think she made the statement, Mr. Chairman, that many people would not want to participate in the program knowing that a lien was going to be placed on their property, but here again, I agree with Al. That's a decision, you know, on their part. If they don't want to participate, if they don't want to take advantage of the tax break, then fine, it's no problem.
Mr. Chairman, there is one other point that has not been discussed, and I don't know whether the committee would like to face that particular problem. I think it is tried to face it in another bill that was introduced. I'm not sure of the number of it. Relating to the applicant as relating to the ownership on a leased piece of ground, now that we have it apparently on away from the income part, 10% income, and we have it on a contribution in terms of amount of acres, income on acres.
Well, we haven't actually passed an amendment to that.
No, but if it was on that case, the problem we have under the income deal is where the applicant is making, the applicant is the owner, and the income that they turn in is from leasing the land. Then we have the other situation where the applicant probably should be the lessee who in the lease agreement is paying the taxes. Now, the bill in its present form, before any amendments, is a little ambiguous on this particular point, and we have interpreted the intent as being that the person actually doing the farming is the one that can be an applicant because he has to make 10% of his income from the farm activity. On the other hand, the person who owns farmland and leasing it is, again, possibly, is making enough to warrant making application. And what the bill, I think, didn't address itself was whether or not the owner of the property who is leasing the ground can be considered actively farming the land for profit.
Well, they don't both have to pay taxes, do they?
No, no.
So who, if a person leases, say, 40 acres of farmland, whose responsibility is it to pay the taxes, the owner or the lessee?
Owner. Depends on the on the lease.
But Mr. Chairman, I don't agree with that. It may or may not depend on the lease who's going to pay the taxes, but it's the land itself that, in the final analysis, that's liable for the tax. If the lessee doesn't pay the tax, then the borough or whoever is going to go against the land. They're not going to go against the lessee.
That's true. Is the person who owns the property and leasing it to a person who is farming, is the owner of the property actively engaged in farming the land for profit? That is the whole, that's the crux of it.
And that, well, how do you work it out?
Well, we had several applications in the Kenai Peninsula Borough where the owner was leasing the land to out for $1 an acre. They had 500 acres and getting $500 income, and he's claiming that that was 10% of his income. In the case of two or three others, they were leasing it to somebody for his garden, to grow garden on for personal use, and we have denied the applicant because he was not actually farming the land.
Well, now, if the other person would have, as part of his lease agreement, been paying the taxes,
then he would be the applicant and he would be eligible. I mean, that is one interpretation.
You allow those situations, though.
Yeah.
My personal opinion is the reason I would vote for a bill like this to give deferred taxes or whatever to any place isn't because of the income of the person or anything. It's because to keep that land open for farming so that it doesn't come in and houses be built upon it. And I don't see where the hang-up is on, you know, as long as the land is kept open for farming or farming purposes or however it's worded exactly, as long as it is kept open, then it should be whoever's paying the taxes, the exemption should be acceptable on it, whether, you know, they're actually engaged in or whether it's being leased out. Because I see that's the purpose for this bill, because you've got a lot of places in South 48 where there's been beautiful farms, and, you know.
That's what we were talking about. If that's the purpose of the bill, House Bill 65 is beautiful. But I'm glad to have that interpretation or your feeling on it, and hopefully that we can administer it in that way. But
I know Bob and I have discussed this problem, but it seems like in this proposed amendment that you've got, it does allow for either. It says to be farm use land, the owner or lessee must be actively engaged, and the land must be derived.
That's in the amendment?
That's in the amendment. Okay. So it does leave it the owner or the lessee, and then it's a determination as to whether the owner is going to get the deferred provision or the lessee will be the one to get the deferred.
I want to clear it up. If put this lien in and I sell the property, the intent that Mr. Hackney is going to keep on farming, and he doesn't. And who is stuck for the back lien? Is it Hackney or I?
You sell it to Hackney?
No.
Well, Well, if he makes application, he can continue it on as long as the use does not change.
Now, if I sell to him with the understanding, I mean, how do we have to prove it? I sold to him with the understanding that he's going to farm it, and he doesn't.
It doesn't really make any difference in the way the bill's written. As long as he doesn't develop it, the lien, he can assume the lien, and it goes on with the property, and he can own it and maintain the lien, maintain the property until he develops it, at which time the lien would become due and payable.
Well, and then he has to pay your back tax?
Right.
For 10 years.
Well, how long does this lien
Ten
affect?
Years.
7 years.
Well, then if he just do it 1 year, and then start subdividing, say, for example.
No, I believe it's 7 years.
7 years.
Or whatever it was, then he would still be. But when would I be liable for the, under what circumstances I'd be liable for it?
In that when he purchased the property from you, he would be smart to check whether it's a lien against the property or not, which is recorded in a district recorder. And almost any person that buys property today is going to have a title search, if possible, which would indicate that there's a lien on the property, and he's aware of that lien when he buys the property, and you would sell it to him under the assumption he would have to assume that he's going to have to take care of that lien at some point in time. It might mean a little less profit to you. He would pay maybe a little less money for the property than he would otherwise because the lien is on it.
Well, I think you know what I'm getting at is I wouldn't be responsible for the lien as long as I sold it.
You would follow the land.
The lien
to the
is
land.
Follows the land.
That's okay. Now, so buyers beware then.
Right. This is the reason for establishing a lien. Then when he buys it, he's aware that there's a lien on that property. And before he buys it, he'd want to find out what he's up against. Okay. He has constructive notice that there's a lien on it that way.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I have one more comment, though, about the time expiration on the lien. Maybe Mr. Dozier would want to comment on that. After 7 years, the lien is...
yes, you're only... for instance, the lien had already been, or the property had deferred taxes for 5 years, and you bought the property, and you maintain it for another 5 years, and then you subdivided it. You would only be liable for 7 years back taxes. The other 3 years that you had it would be forgiven. Only for 7 years back is as far as they can go.
But they always can go back to seven.
Just 7 years on the way.
That's
the present
law.
Yeah.
Nobody's proposed to change it. Well, I think that the next question we have to decide then is if do we want to change the eligibility requirements as far as income.
Yeah, that I think should, but I don't know if this is the proper one.
Well, you got another suggestion?
Well, you know, $1,000 on 40 acres, that isn't. Of course, again, if you just want to keep it for grazing land or anything else, keep it open.
Can they figure in kind value on that, perhaps on their 10% income now? Like if they had horses grazing on some property, could they say, well, it's worth so much for them to have the horses fed and so forth? If they would have had to feed them another way, it would have cost them a certain amount of money.
The way it is right now, they have to show it on their gross income, on their income tax return, that they did have income from the farm. The use of the land as
has to be cash income.
Yeah, has to be in monetary, show up on the income tax return as farm income.
And are you able to check that now? You said you were having some problems or there people were unhappy about it. Can you go over to the Department of Revenue and look at somebody's income tax?
No, I can't, but what I do is we send over a waiver form that we've had to the Department of Revenue, who checks it for us and say either they qualify or they do not. We don't see any. Our division doesn't see the income tax return per se.
And under something like this, do you envision them showing you the receipts? I mean, that would be a difference. They could show you $1,000 worth of receipts for
In this case, they would have to show the assessor that that they made the receipts for income, rather than their income tax return. They would show something that would show that they actually sold the product or made this money.
Seems like it'd be a lot easier, and wouldn't it be less an invasion of privacy, or to some people's way of thinking. Just have to show the amount of money rather than a percentage.
It would take away the stigma of this income tax, apparently, privacy point of view. And by the way, it's done in several states in this manner.
You don't have any idea what their dollar amounts are, though?
Well, I've seen everything from $500 an acre on down, but it would appear to be a, whether it's a reasonable figure, I couldn't say exactly, but it appears to be somewhat near.
Somewhat near?
Near a reasonable figure, but I really couldn't
say. I'd say it's probably pretty close to it too, since as you earlier pointed out, not a whole lot of people make a whole lot of money farming around this state.
It isn't that, I think that what we're trying to do, as it was pointed out, is only a token amount that would indicate that they are making an effort to do something. Not that they're making a whole amount of money or anything else on it. Big operation, it's just to keep it in farmland.
Mr. Dozier mentioned Hospital 65, and I'm wondering what relationship the two bills, this bill and the, I know that the Senate has changed Hospital 65 considerably, and I see Jack Shinnelik is here, and he's been working on those revisions.
I just got through reviewing Hospital 65, and I think they really did a good job on it. And they have a provision in there for a lien against the state, by the way.
Right. Right.
As one of the things, have you had a chance to really closely examine
the new committee substitute from Community and Regional Affairs in the Senate? Yes, and I think they did a good job on it too. But I wonder, I'm not able to really compare piece for piece that bill.
I think they're
this
more
one
concerned
I'm
with development rights. Is really what they're trading off here on the new Senate committee substitute.
The criterion on getting established or getting making application in this 65 is based on whether you have been a resident for 10 years and have a piece of ground between 3 and 160 acres. And farming is great. You can still get it. That's the criterion. Income has no bearing on it. Whether it's undeveloped land or farmland, it's all included. Even a single-family residence on it, well, you have to have a single-family residence on it. If you have owned it and lived on it for 10 years, you normally would have. But that's the criterion of getting into the program. And once you're into the program, there's no way, and it goes back, by the way, for 10 years at 8% interest. But there's no way that, as long as it's not undeveloped, as long as it's undeveloped, the lien can remain with the property. If the owner wishes to.
Do you have any idea when it's going to lease out of financing?
No. I don't have any idea. Might not ever.
That's why I kind of hesitate to try to build one on the provisions of the other, since we don't know what the fate of the other is.
Mr. Chairman?
What did you say?
On the 40 acres, couldn't we break that down on an acreage basis here, the first say, $25 of gross farming income for any acreage to 40, 40 and additional 10 for each acre over the first 40?
That'd make them get
It would mean the same thing. The only thing is you break it down from 1 to 40, $25.
$25 an acre the first 40, that'd be $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And then $10 after that.
$10 after that, it would fall in line with what's here. I don't know much about farming. How many acres you have to farm?
It seems like that'd be a little bit more of an even break on a scale anyway. Rather than do it just lump sum $1,000 for 1 acre or for 40 acres. Well, do you want to make a motion?
I'll make a motion, Mr. Chairman.
OK. Okay, the motion is then to...
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Parliamentary inquiry, we haven't adopted that amendment.
We haven't adopted any amendment at all, no. So his, I assume that your motion included the...
It would be delete the 1,000 in there, insert 25, and then delete from after acreage, the first acreage there.
Okay, well, it's basically the same proposal as the amendment listed on here that we have. And I assume he was moving, I assume he was making the motion to move the amendment with the change.
If we're gonna make it 25, couldn't you go up past 40 acres?
Huh?
Go past 40 acres.
Well, yeah, an additional $10 for each acre for the first 40, just break it down.
I don't hear, I don't see anybody saying that up to 40 acres, say up to 100 acres.
$25? I'm not sure why they don't break there either, unless somebody had something in mind. Seems pretty haphazard, we're doing the same thing.
Yeah. Well, 100 is a nice round figure. And that's only 20...
40 is divisible by 2.
That's only $2,500 for 100 acres, if you're gonna do any...
See, well, then you could just have $25 an acre for any acreage.
Just delete the last part of it.
Okay.
What was that?
Besides that, when you go to the metric system...
Right.
It's not gonna be around here anymore.
So if I could, I think I can restate the motion now as it stands, and that would be to, must be actively engaged in farming land and derive a minimum of $25 gross farm income per acre for all the land included. We could probably have some little fancier language drawn up, but I think we understand the idea there of the motion. $25 an acre, Mr. Coachman.
Mr. Chairman, how would this apply? A person who would be farming, let's say the 40 acres or 100 acres or whatever it is, and they own and make $5,000 on that potatoes or something, maybe $10,000 on that 100 acres. But they have enough income to qualify for two or three pieces that they might have also in the same valley, as if on the, you might be, they wouldn't be farming them necessarily, but they would own the property. Now, could they pull that in and say, okay, I'm, by that income, it qualifies me for another 100 acres up on the north slope up here, for the farm use deferred tax.
So. Well, how do you do it now if there's more than one parcel?
Well, actually, it should be done in the way that if they're farming 40 acres of 160 acres, they should have that farm use assessment on the 40 acres, but we've been giving it to them on the whole thing.
If it's all one parcel.
If they're farming, they have to be farming at some point on each parcel, two or three parcels in the area. If they're farming 10 or 20 acres of 160, we give them the whole 160, and they might have two or three pieces scattered around. It's all in one farm unit, so to speak. They've been getting it on all of it.
You're saying if they've got two separated parcels, and they're farming, perhaps the first one's 160, and they're farming 20 of that, you give them the
whole
the,
thing.
Okay, the whole 160, but right. You don't necessarily extend that to the other parcel.
Not unless they're farming on it.
They have to be farming on the other parcel as well. Well, okay, well, in that case, then they wouldn't be able to disqualify for a north slope special assessment unless they were farming on it.
Well, I was just wondering if the language needed clarifying from that standpoint.
Well, that was the question I asked. I hope you understood you that there had to be the... Not that they're farming on, not just to take over. That's why surely I want that clarified so that there isn't that problem. If you're not taking one little piece and then getting exempt from other holdings.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, but this only speaks to farm use. Well,
it just
doesn't include
interest. That's why I understood it, but then when the Stouser come to wealth and they bring in other lands they own.
Well, from what he said after that, is that each parcel has to have some farming activity on it before it can even begin to qualify.
Well, how would you decide this parcel, and how do you define that? But I can think of some of the farmers there in the valley that they have one setting here, 60 acres, another one maybe 3 miles away.
Yeah, Mrs. Kellogg has several, 7 or 8 parcels, and she's farming maybe 20 acres on 160 and 40 acres on another 40 acres on another piece and this sort of thing. And it's scattered all over the valley, but they're actually doing some farming. She's leasing it to different people throughout the valley, and she's getting it on the whole thing.
Well, I'm not so concerned about her. I know her operation too, but I was thinking that some of them that they may let the land rest for the 1 year, you know, not crop it, and which some of them do. Instead of fertilizing, they just let it rest. Well, then they're going to be stuck that 1 year.
What's the way they could probably, if they have a 160-acre parcel, and they're only farming, say, 20 or 40 acres, well, they could let those 20 rest, and they could farm a different part of it.
Well, I mean, it isn't one parcel. They have a fairly thing like my neighbor. He has a scattered...
Hamilton?
Yeah, around, see, and so that leave less later. Well, is he going to get stuck then in alternate years?
Well, I don't think we're changing anything.
No.
As far as that goes.
It's just the formula, that's all.
All we're doing here is allowing them to get out of having their income tax dug into. That's the way I understand it. They're going to, 10%, they're going to have to show much production anyway. And they're going to have to show much under this either. So I don't really think it's much of a major change as far as that goes. Any other discussion on the motion?
Well, I just wonder if that $25 straight through is going to fly, though. I don't think that'll fly. If you get up into a larger acreage. No, there's a minute, $25 per acre.
Oh, I thought you just amended $25 up to 40.
No, we change it up to $25 per acre.
$25 an acre all the way through. Anybody is okay. All in favor of the motion? Anybody opposed? So we have 3 amendments.
Mr. Chairman, I think we've worked hard enough this morning.
Okay, is there anything, anybody feel like we left anything out?
It takes care of all of hers.
Well, except for she wasn't, this one here, I think we've taken care of a different way. Mr. Dozier, Paul?
Did you take action on the amendment of going back to the original language of...
On the lien?
Getting rid of that incompatible...
No, that's still in there.
It, as originally written?
We're amending Senate Bill 529 amended. And we've amended it in such a manner that we've got 3 amendments to it. We've allowed them an exemption to the timely filing. We've put back the lien provision, and we've added that $25 an acre income requirement.
He was speaking of the uses incompatible with farm.
Incompatible with farm use. Back to the original language.
We didn't change that.
You're going to leave it?
Let's take it out.
Well, that's a matter of discussion, I suppose.
Well, we discussed it, on whether the original language is better than this amended language.
But there wasn't an amendment. We didn't make an amendment to the bill we have before us.
I'd so moved. We return to other than farm uses and non-farm use. Well, that's on the last page. Scattered throughout. And that phrase, Mr. Chairman, uses incompatible with farm use is very ambiguous. I don't see how, like Mr. Dozier said, I don't know how they determine that. And
I think it's kind of a vague phrase, but I'm not all that uncomfortable with it myself. I think it was more in line with when we refer to House Bill 65. I think it's close to that as far as the philosophy of the land use is concerned.
I'm for your motion, I think.
What are the virtues of this then is compatible with, the language is compatible with 65?
Well, I think that, I still don't really understand this whole thing all that well, but it seems to me that if you say farm use purposes, it's pretty restrictive. And still, that's kind of vague, since Mr. Dozier says that if they have 160 acres and they're only farming 20, the rest of it isn't farm use purpose, and they're still given the exemption. So if you, obviously the rest of it wouldn't be incompatible with farm use, so that's why they'd be able to.
I'm not saying it's right.
Well, I think it would be right, if that's the practice, and if we were to say use is incompatible, then it would be right, or it would be legal anyway. That's just my interpretation.
Mr. Chairman? How would you identify compatible to farm use in other use of the land?
First, how would I identify?
Yeah.
Well, I'd say that there are some pretty obvious incompatible uses, like, you know, houses and
golf courses.
Well, I don't know about a golf course. You know, you can graze animals on a golf course.
No, they don't even get out. They get out there too.
They have sand greens, I think.
I think that there opened up a can of worms that ain't sure
to me. To me, I would seem that it would open up better uses other than farm use.
I think that for uses incompatible farm uses is the correct way to go with it myself. When you say other than farm purposes, when you say farm, a lot of people think of pigs and chickens and stuff like this, but if you can also have, you know, where I came from originally as a little tiny girl, they didn't call them farms, they called them ranches. You even had a pea ranch, you didn't have a pea farm, you know. And, I mean, it's just the terminology from different parts of the country. And when you say other than farm use purposes, the first thing that came to my mind, and this really will probably sound corny, but if it's being used for anything other than farm use purposes underneath that title, it sounds like you couldn't get an exemption. And going through Texas, I remember the great wheat fields, and here once in a while was a birdie pumping oil. And would that be declared, you know, you were using it for something than other farm use, because you were pumping oil out of there too, but I mean, it would, you know, a little tiny thing like this, it was sitting there pumping and wheat growing all around it. And I think when you say use incompatible with farm use,
this isn't what this is.
If you had a whole refinery or something there,
right,
obviously
then it would be incompatible. But when I'm saying, when you put down the words, if we were to leave the original language other than farm use purposes, I'm wondering if, you know, if somebody, I can't think of a situation in Alaska like that, but that was the first thing that just came to my mind, that you could have some little tiny thing going on it, that they might say, well, that's the main, you know, source of income and all that type of stuff, and, you know, even though you had your money, it was being used for something other than that.
Well, just, you know, in reference to your to the bill that I know you're very interested in, it seems like if a person were to leave the land undeveloped, whether he's farming it or not, it would qualify here, and as I understand it, they qualify anyway right now. Isn't that correct,
well,
Mr. Dozier?
Yes, as long as they're farming a portion of it.
Yeah. So the rest of the land wouldn't have to actually be tilled and plowed and planted, as long as it was still compatible with farm use.
Well, the use, as has been pointed out, the terminology of the use, it can be for grazing, it can be for or pasture or anything. It doesn't have to be tilled per se.
Right.
Okay, that's fair.
Lisa?
The definition does not include grazing in that sort of thing. In order to be eligible for the exemption in the first place, you have to be farming part of it, though.
Yeah.
So that if we left uses incompatible with farm use, the situation would be this, am I right? That a person would have to be using some land for farm use, but if that farm use should be discontinued and the land should be used for some other purpose which was found to be not incompatible with farm use, then the exemption, you give me a golf course, that's not incompatible with farm use, maybe, then the land would continue to be available, eligible for the exemption, even if the land were allowed to, for instance, lie fallow, or were, for instance, maybe allowed to reforest itself, that would that be not incompatible?
I would say that would be not incompatible, but at the same time, a portion of the land would still have to be producing at the rate of $25 an acre. If they had 100 acres and they were only farming 20 of it, they still have to make $2,500.
But it says in the language, should the farm use land be sold, leased, or otherwise disposed of for uses incompatible with farm use, which would mean the entire package, I would think.
And or be converted to a use by the owner.
Mm-hmm. Then it's, I don't like that language, because it could be anything at all. Incompatible with farm use. That's pretty broad.
I'm comfortable with it.
Yeah, let's leave it.
You can still make a motion. I'm sure that's still proper if you want.
Okay, well,
I peel off now.
That we agree. Do you want to talk to me?
Well, I'm just. Would it still, the second part of it, or be converted to a use incompatible by farm use by the owner? I don't know whether that means that the owner would still have to be farming part of it to be eligible or not.
In order to receive the annual exemption, you'd have to qualify as to the, you still have to do some farming, you still have to meet that qualification.
But Mr. Chairman, if I may continue, it says here, and I need to take lines, the owner shall be liable to pay an amount equal to the additional tax if he does do this conversion to a use incompatible. That's talking about the whole. And I think that's very hard to determine. That language doesn't sound appropriate to me. So I'm.
That's real broad, too. Other than identifying farms. We're talking about farms again, I think. Start changing the subject here, and you could do a whole kind of work.
The Smithers said as.
There's another way we could go, whoever's going to define incompatible with farm use, I suppose it will be, would it be you, Mr. Dozier?
Shall I move that?
I presume it would be administrative.
I'd like to finish work on the building. I think it's finished up until this point, so.
Can I just move that, and if it gives me five?
Okay, all in favor of Kathleen's motion to go back to the original language ratio? Well, you're gonna go back?
Yeah, I got to accept.
To the farm use purpose.
Yes.
So opposed?
Let's go back.
Motion fails, 4-4.
Who's the fourth one? I thought you had.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Does somebody want to move the bill out?
I would move the bill out.
All right, now the amendments, we passed three amendments on it, so I'd like
what
to.
What is it?
I thought you had your hand raised.
We have to put it together again before we actually sign it.
Okay, as long as the. I'll have a committee substitute drawn up. But I hope nobody has any more amendments after we've done that.
I don't know why we're thinking that.